This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We're back with our friend Paul Beckwith, and there's a common interest that we have here that I'd like to just quickly chat with Paul about. And that is this, about a month ago, I did a program on geoengineering, and I had David Keith, a Canadian scientist, actually, who was talking about his research into it. And we also had a psychologist named Rose Cairns, who was talking about her study into the chemtrails movement, which is now prefers to call itself the anti-climate geoengineering movement. Want to be more scientific about it, they say. So these are a field of interest where, Paul, you and I cross somewhat. I know that after that show, I got some hate mail claiming that I was guilty of crimes and would be tried for it later when people woke up to the truth about spraying the skies. And I know David Keith has really been vilified for it. So there's two prime questions in my mind right now, Paul. The first one is, do you think we would know if there was geoengineering going on right now on a scale that could actually influence the climate?
That's a great question. I would hope not, because it certainly isn't working if it's being done. Would we know? I think it would be hard to hide something like that. You know, if spraying was being done, for example, you know, if the chemtrails were being done, it makes perfect sense that this would be done over the Arctic to try to cool it, as opposed to, you wouldn't do it widespread globally, especially if there were chemicals that were harmful to crops and things. You know, I mean, I'd like to see some science from those people. I'd like to see traces like chemical analysis of soils, for example, put in peer-reviewed papers showing, you know, definite high concentrations of aluminum or barium or whatever the chemicals are supposed to be. Like, a conspiracy theory is generally propagated by a small group of people. I mean, it's very, very unusual and difficult to have it propagated by a large number of people. I mean, for example, you know, you have 97-98% of climate scientists are in some conspiracy. I mean, this is completely absurd, right? I mean, we've never had any conspiracy theories that could be, you know, involve so many people. So, you know, but because the climate is changing so quickly, I mean, I can, you know, explain most of the events that are happening around the world just based on the Arctic temperature amplification and the jet streams and how that is having an effect. I can explain things with that, whereas other people that don't understand those connections, you know, are trying to invoke things like geoengineering spraying and stuff, and that just doesn't make any sense at all to me. So, but if somebody was doing it and it caused, you know, some crazy extreme thing someplace, how would we be able to detect that based on all these other crazy extreme things that are happening because of the jet streams in the Arctic, right? It would make it more difficult, but that would be, you know, in terms of identifying that it was happening from the result, from the symptoms. But, you know, I think identifying that it was happening from, you know, on the ground, you know, evidence would be easier to do.
Well, that's my position. I mean, we generally have a science-based program here, and I'm looking for scientists who have investigated this, have, as you say, published in peer-reviewed journals, and I can't find any to interview. So that's one problem. Now, their reply is, well, any scientist that did this would immediately lose their jobs. But my experience of scientists is there's tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of scientists around the world, and there's always somebody who's willing to go out on a limb and check out something even though it's forbidden. So I'm doubtful about that.
Yeah, I'm very it's not happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, the other side of the coin, though, is you think it should happen.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, and it took me a long time to get to this view. I mean, I was completely against it initially, but as the Arctic has warmed, as the jet streams have fractured and become wavy and broken and extreme weather events are taking off, I mean, this is going to get far, far worse as we go to a blue ocean event. We're just scratching the surface of it. It's going to get an order of magnitude or more worse. I mean, instead of having a city flooded out, a couple cities a year, you know, we're talking dozens of cities a year. We can't imagine. I mean, we think it's bad now. What is it going to be like in 5 years after if there's a blue ocean event? A lot worse. And I don't think we can. It's not necessary that we allow this to happen. You know, we need to slash emissions. There's no question. I think we will eventually apply the weight of the mighty dollar, for example, the dollars that are going into the U.S. military budgets of $700 billion a year, you know, take a year and have all those high-tech companies that are manufacturing the latest and greatest in killing machines and apply them to figuring out ways to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, to get bamboo to grow at high latitudes, you know, increase kelp growth, maybe use algae for biofuels, biochar techniques for soils, you know, just extract, get those CO2 levels down. But in order to stabilize the thermodynamic system of the planet, you know, if we want to go back to any semblance of weather patterns that we had before the rapid acceleration of extreme weather events, then we need to cool the Arctic, and we know how to do that. So yeah, I've strongly felt this way. Just Google anthropogenic Arctic volcano. You know, I wrote about it many years ago. And I've come to this because, you know, you need to really weigh the pros and cons of doing it, right? And if we don't do it, then things are going to get far worse. Our weather extremes are going to skyrocket. We will reach a global food crisis because different parts, you know, when we get a synchronization of food crop failures, then food prices will spike, and that will cause unrest, global unrest, and bring down governments and so on and so forth. So this is a very serious problem, you know. So, you know, on the plus side, I think it will amaze everybody how quickly the world governments and public changes their views on climate change. Right now, I think it would be fair to say that the vast majority of the public and governments don't see climate change as a real threat. And I think that they'll go from that position, that view, to saying, we're doomed. There's nothing we can do. We're like, we've messed it up and there's nothing we can do. Woe is us. We're all going to go the way of the dinosaurs. So it'll go to that, and then it will come back to, okay, we can do this, we can do this, we can do this. You know, we treat this, we throw a lot of dollars, a lot of ingenuity, a lot of engineers. You know, we treat this as a threat to human survival on this planet, civilization survival. And then we, you know, all this money that we throw at it, we innovate, we do things, and we pull ourselves out from the brink, right? I mean, there's people, a lot of people that don't think we can do that, including, of course, Guy McPherson and others, and they may be right, but whether they're, if they're, you know, wrong or right, it doesn't matter. We have to try to do something.
All right. Now, there was a group of U.S. scientists who have called on the U.S. government to go ahead and approve some geoengineering research, at least. Where are geoengineering discussions and research now?
I'm on some discussion groups, geoengineering discussion groups, like with scientists. So, you know, there's lots of ideas about what to do. You know, the simplest way to cool the Arctic is to put sulfur dioxide up into the atmosphere, the stratosphere over the Arctic. You know, of course, that would cause cooling in the summer, in the Arctic summer, but what would it do in the Arctic winter? It could actually even cause warming in the Arctic winter. So there's schemes of using marine cloud brightening instead. And then, you know, once you shut off your devices, it completely stops. And that's to create low-level marine clouds to cool the ocean water moving up into the Arctic. You know, the biochar methods are very, very interesting. You know, kelp beds in the ocean absorb huge amounts of carbon, huge amounts. So if we can maybe expand them somehow, you know, then, you know, we could have a big impact. I mean, just stopping some of the things we're doing, like, you know, if we normally cut down so many trees per year and, you know, we stopped cutting down those trees per year, is that geoengineering? I mean, nobody would consider it that way, right? Like geoengineering, it really needs to be divided into carbon dioxide removal, and solar radiation management. Now, I'm saying that we have to slash emissions and we have to do both. But at least the people that are opposed to, when you talk about people and say, what are you opposed to with geoengineering, they're really talking about the idea of, say, sulfur in the atmosphere. Almost exclusively, they're saying we can't do that, right? That's a terrible thing to do. But ask them about biochar, ask them about removing CO2 from the atmosphere, and suddenly they're not against that anymore, right? So these things are all lumped into one category, and that's a mistake.
Yeah, it's a tough one, you know, because there is a history of governments doing some really rotten things, and we find out about it 30 to 50 years later. It's finally revealed. One of my favorites was the Clinton administration in the 1990s admitted that there had been research on African-American men in the Middle South, Missouri, and Mississippi to see what happens if you inject people with plutonium. You know, a terrible, terrible thing, and they finally admit to it 30 years later. So I guess I can't call them chemtrails people anymore because they don't like it. They want to be called anti-climate geoengineering people. They feel that, well, this could be going on and we'll find out about it, you know, 30 years from now. And it is possible that the U.S. military is researching this. Maybe they've got a couple of planes up there spraying something just to see what happens.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure, like, a couple of planes is, one thing, but changing the view of the skies across North America, as the claims are, you know, is something on a totally different scale, right? I mean, the UK had an experiment, I think they were calling it the Spice or something. They wanted to fly up a weather balloon and then have a hose running up and then spray water into the atmosphere, you know, a kilometer up or something, and that was shut down. They weren't able to do that. That was, you know, of course, we had in Canada, we had the guy dumping the iron.
Oh, yeah. Russ George was trying to feed the algae off the coast of British Columbia.
Yes, and they dumped, I don't know how many tons of iron. And the interesting thing is they had record plankton runs the two subsequent years. You know, so he was, of course, claiming that, yes, the super growth of the algae, and then it was food, and then the fish went up the trophic, up the food chain, and then, the salmon were in record numbers. And, you know, there's no scientist has conclusively said that that's the case, but it's extremely interesting. I think it's probably, you know, what he did created those salmon runs. I think that's highly likely. So we have people doing this sort of thing. Of course, if people start doing it, right, you know, if countries start doing it and then there's a massive monsoon failure, then of course, you know, that's going to be blamed for being the cause of it, right? Like if we were doing it and, you know, the Calgary got flooded out because of the jet streams, and then a lot of the general public can say, oh, you know, it's because of what we were doing. I mean, it's interesting to look back at the history of some of the, you know, weather modification techniques, because I think the U.S. military were experimenting ways to divert hurricanes. They were doing something to try to divert a hurricane, and then it went the wrong way and came over a city, and they stopped all those experiments, and that was all hush-hush, right? Like, I don't know. I mean, for this to ever be applied successfully, you know, the idea of we need complete transparency. We need an international group or something, but people are going to try it. I think that's pretty much guaranteed.
Yes, I think it will come, and I don't know what to think about it myself.
Yeah, I mean, we have to talk about technology in that case, right? Like, I love Jacques Ellul's book, a French philosopher. He wrote some really good tech books about technology, how it develops, you know, in the 50s and 60s, and, you know, it's a great read. I mean, technology is really pulls society along. It's not the other way around. I mean, we don't think we need to do something, so we invent a technology for it. Usually the technology is developed and then it's applied to all these different things, right? And then usually it's the technology is pulling along the direction of society as opposed to the other way around.
But right now, we do have a need for some sort of carbon removal technology, so I think that need may draw out some research.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. But, you know, who knows? Maybe there's some technology from some other field that we can just apply over to geoengineering, and it works great at removing carbon. We just haven't identified that application yet.
Well, I appreciate your talking with me, Paul Beckwith. Thanks again for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you, Alec.
Get all the links for this week's interviews in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you for listening, and thank you for caring about our world. We'll be right back.